This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Nearly a week later, eastern North Carolina continues to clean up from the giant Category 1 hurricane that impacted coastal areas last weekend. The floodwater has gone down, and the rain has mostly dried up, but it will take time for North Carolina's shell fishery to recover. Sandy dumped several inches of rain across eastern North Carolina, and tropical storm force winds caused water to back up into rivers and sounds.
I've never seen anything quite like it in my entire career.
John Cole is the warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service office in Newport.
I think at one point the tropical storm force winds extended across at least 800 miles.
In North Carolina, the Outer Banks took the brunt of the storm.
Dare County, they had the heaviest rainfall. That only compounded the surge issues as well. They had anywhere from 5 to 8 inches of storm total rainfall there.
Official damage estimates have not been released. However, along the Outer Banks, sections of Highway 12 and Highway 158 were washed out and covered by sand. Property was damaged, and homes were flooded as a result of 3 to 6 feet of ocean and soundside storm surge. Cole says the Inner Banks saw moderate impacts from the tropical system.
40 to 60 mile per hour wind gusts during the storm across the central counties there. And rainfall was less, probably in the range of 2 to 4 inches, maybe up isolated amounts up to 5 inches.
Stormwater runoff occurred during Hurricane Sandy as large amounts of rainfall flowed into coastal waters and sounds. Since shellfish are filter feeders, they ingest the sediment, debris, household hazardous waste, and chemicals in the water, making them unsafe to eat. This prompted the North Carolina Department of Marine Fisheries to implement shellfish closures on Sunday. Section Chief for Shellfish Sanitation and Recreational Water Quality, Patty Fowler, says the closures impact almost all coastal counties.
So the heaviest closure, New Hanover County, Tender County, and then up in Hyde and Dare counties and the northern counties are all closed to shellfishing. We have closures here in Carteret County, but not all waters are closed.
Newport River, North River, Wifers Creek, Sleepy Creek, Jarrett Bay, Oyster Creek, Nelson Bay, and South River are some of the areas close to oyster harvesting.
The waters from the intercoastal waterway to the mainland in from the Atlantic Beach Bridge all the way down to New River, so that would include the main mainland creeks and tributaries along Bogue Sound, White Oak River, and those areas down in Onslow County also.
Fowler says the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries began taking water samples on Wednesday to determine the level of pollutants in the water. When bacteria levels return to normal, she says they will reopen the waters for shellfish harvesting. According to a press release sent out by the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries, all those waters in Pender and Onslow counties that were temporarily closed will return to the status in existence prior to Hurricane Sandy. That includes waters between Intercoastal Waterway Marker No. 15 near Chadwick Bay and the Surf City Bridge, as well as Stump Sound and Alligator Bay. Oyster season began on October 15th, and the beginning of mechanical harvesting is set for November 12th. Oyster sales generate between $2 to $5 million annually, depending on how good the year is. Michael Marshall is the Central District Manager for the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries. He says this year looks promising, or questionable, depending on whom you talk to.
Some areas, the fishermen were not having a lot of luck getting their 5-bushel limit, but in other places they were able to catch their limit fairly early and had some pretty oysters. So it kind of depends on the area that you're in as to what kind of season they're seeing so far.
Months that end in R are traditionally when oysters are eaten. But Marshall says North Carolina oysters are often in better condition later in the season in January or February.
The Super Bowl actually does have a little bit of an uptick in the market around that. I guess you could call that a holiday almost as well.
Whether it's a football game, holiday meal, or backyard roast, oysters are in high demand this time of year. There's also a variety of ways to prepare them. You can steam them, bake them, or just plain eat them raw. This week, food writer and restaurant critic Eddie Browning shares his recipe for Inner Banks Oyster Chowder, a recipe passed down from his grandmother.
It's a classic Inner Banks recipe. And I've also made a few twists to it.
All right, where do we begin? What's the first step?
You use 6 slices of thick-cut bacon, your favorite bacon. Cut it into lardons or 2 tablespoons of canola oil for a healthier version.
Could you substitute real bacon for turkey bacon?
Oh, yes, I've done that.
And how does it turn out?
I think it turns out fine. And so I render that until crisp. I use medium heat. So take 2 leeks. Use the white and pale green parts only, half them horizontally, and thinly slice them into half moons.
And that's something about leeks, too. You know, if they're not washed good enough, they can have lots of sand and grit in them. How do you recommend washing them?
I cut them, trim them up a little bit, and I run water through it. You know, I'll use a good 3 washings. You do not want grit in your soup. And I saute, and I want to stir them off. I don't want them to turn brown. I want to, you know, keep them green looking and just wilt them down, basically 3 to 5 minutes. And then we're basically making a roux next. I like to sprinkle the flour and stir it. And once it's combined real well, you need to cook it for a few minutes to get that flour taste out of it. That's when you want to whisk in the clam juice, the milk, the cream, and your reserved oyster juice. Then add your potatoes, and then bring all that to boil over a high heat. And as soon as it comes to the boil, reduce that heat to low and let it simmer until the potatoes are tender. Again, that takes roughly around 10 minutes.
Now, when I've tried to cook chowder before, it kind of turns out a little bit runny. What are some ways that you can thicken up your chowder?
Take some of the potatoes out and mash them, and then re-add them and stir them into the soup.
All right, what's next?
Add 2 8-ounce containers of oysters that you've drained, cleaned, looked over. Add the oysters and simmer uncovered.
You don't want to overcook oysters because they can end up tasting very rubbery.
Oh, you sure don't.
What is the trick to knowing when they're done?
When the edges curl, you'll see them slightly curl up. And I think normally 3 minutes is max. Very last, add that sherry. Stir, combine, and serve them in a nice, hot, deep bowl.
And, of course, you can't have chowder without some crackers or toasted bread to go along with it.
That's right.
What do you like along with a good bowl of chowder?
I like cornbread. That would be my favorite.
Well, Eddie, once again, thanks so much for sharing this recipe. Appreciate it.
Jared, thank you.
You can find Eddie's recipe for Inner Banks Oyster Chowder, as well as other oyster recipes, at our website, publicradioeast.org.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. With Hurricane Sandy having brushed by our coast this week, although we were very lucky here in eastern North Carolina, it does make you think about what plants might be best suited for our area for those times when the hurricane comes a little closer, when we're dealing with salt water coming in, strong winds, salt in the wind, all the things that make growing plants difficult. Well, I wanted to share with you a wonderful document that the Master Gardeners of Carteret County have put together. You can find it on our County Cooperative Extension website, which is at carteret.ces, that stands for Cooperative Extension Service, .ncsu, that stands for North Carolina State University, .edu. Don't put www in there or you'll never find the site. Once you open the Carteret County website, then click on Lawn and Garden and scroll down to the links at the bottom. There's a section called Carteret County Specialty Horticulture for our local growing conditions, but this list would apply to almost anywhere on the North Carolina coast. Underneath that heading, there's a document called Plants for Hurricanes. Now, this is a particularly interesting document because it was put together by a group of master gardeners over multiple years, watching and seeing how plants performed in their own yards after hurricanes. Based on all that observation, they put together a wonderful list, breaking plants down into categories based on how well they do in these situations. The first heading is the Special 15. These are plants that came up over and over on every gardener's list as plants that survived fairly good hurricanes unscathed. They include akuba, which is the gold dust plant, all sorts of bulbs and tubers, which die back but then return fine in the spring, things such as lilies and cannas, camellias, iliagnus, hollies, Indian hawthorn, sable minor palms, yuccas, pittosporum, all of them did very, very well. And there's others in that special 15. Then there's a group called the runners-up. These are plants that survived without any problem, but had initial damage that they had to recover from. This includes American holly, azaleas, crepe myrtles, flowering quince, fringe trees, gardenias, nandinas, lauropetalum, a range of plants in this category as well. Finally, there's a category where most plants were damaged with burned leaves and broken branches, but did recover and survive. That would include roses, Confederate jasmine, redbud, and viburnum. And finally, the category of plants which were very sensitive to and severely harmed by the stresses of a storm, and that therefore aren't recommended by our master gardeners. Although they might survive and do fine in many hurricane situations, overall they tend to have more problems than the other. This would be the dogwood, the Japanese maple, maple trees in general, river birch, and almost all annuals. There's other plants on this list as well. In addition to this list put together by the Master Gardeners of Carteret County, under the same heading of specialty horticulture, you'll also find a University of Florida document, Trees for Hurricanes. That has all sorts of good information to help you select trees for your yard and also to help you take care of your trees after a hurricane. So, we're glad that Sandy didn't do much harm to us here and wish she had done the same for New England. But it gives us a chance to think about what we might want to change or add to our yard in the future for this hurricane-prone area. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
It's a crushing reality for adults 65 and older. Alzheimer's affects about 1 in 50 seniors in North Carolina. Growing older is the biggest risk for developing the brain disease, which causes problems with memory, thinking, and behavior. Although scientists haven't been able to pinpoint the exact cause of the disease, the number of North Carolinians with Alzheimer's is on the rise. There is over 170,000 older adults with Alzheimer's or other types of dementia in the state. The executive director of Alzheimer's North Carolina, Alice Watkins, expects that number to grow to 210,000 by 2025.
We've been in this epidemic for a while. It's just that people are finally realizing that it's more prevalent than most people had thought. And now that we're in the baby boomer bracket for people to develop this disease, the numbers are going to grow in the years ahead.
Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia and results in the loss of cognitive abilities. The disease first strikes the hippocampus, the part of the brain that is critical for learning and memory processes. As the number of cases increase, so will the cost of caring for patients.
The caregiving aspect of long-term care is, on an average now, is between $4,000 to $6,000 a month.
And where do you expect those numbers to go as dementia
increases?
All those
are going to soar.
According to a survey by the state's Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, 28% of North Carolina residents are providing regular care or assistance to an older adult with a long-term illness or disability. Almost half of these caregivers report the person they are caring for has memory loss, confusion, or a disorder like Alzheimer's. Caring for someone who has the disease can be stressful and overwhelming.
The number one stressor for caregivers of Alzheimer's patients is repeated questions.
Michelle Bourgeois is a speech pathology professor at Ohio State University.
The main memory problem of people with Alzheimer's and dementia is that they can't put information into memory to store it, to retrieve it later. So they appear to understand what you say when you answer their question, but it doesn't get stored.
As part of her PhD research in the 1980s, Bourgeois found that writing something down for an Alzheimer's patient, instead of telling them, increased the likelihood that they would be able to retain the information longer. That's when she developed the idea of a memory book.
Those are simply collections of pictures and captions that document the person's life, starting at when they were born and going through their whole life history. And the success I had there was for helping people to remember who all the people were in their family and the happy memories they had. Sometimes those get fuzzy later on, and having actual pictures and captions keep those memories active.
Caregivers who report back to Bourgeois find the memory books aren't just useful for conversation. They also help people with Alzheimer's remember events.
I had one daughter whose father could not remember that his wife had died. And every day he would ask the daughter where the wife was, and she'd have to repeat the whole story about how the mother has had cancer and died. And the father, upon hearing that every time, it was news to him, and he was upset, and they ended up crying. So I suggested that they make a page for his memory book that told that story. And so there was a picture of the grave site where the wife was buried, and it said, "My wife Lillian lies peacefully here after succumbing to her battle with cancer," and the date. And then the next time the father asked the daughter where his wife was, she directed him to the memory book. He read about it instead of her telling him the story, and he did not have that same emotional reaction. It was more neutral, and his response was, "Oh, yes, that's where she is. Now I remember."
Alzheimer's affects the part of the brain that stores memory, making it difficult to recall past events. However, using photographs with captions gives people with the disease an external space to store the information. This technique works well for people with mild and severe cases of Alzheimer's, but at the advanced stage of dementia, patients rarely are able to talk.
I had a caregiver who asked me to work with his wife, who was in that condition, and I was very surprised that showing this woman large pictures, you know, so blowing the pictures up to a big size where she could see them and increasing the size of the print really large so that she could see a word, she was able to look at that and change the tenor of her vocalization. So this woman spent a lot of her time making noises and sounds that seemed angry and agitated. But then when we showed her the pictures of her husband, her kids, her grandkids with their names, just their names, she started humming and making more pleasant sounds.
Bourgeois has written several books explaining her technique. It's also taught in speech pathology master's training programs across the country. In eastern North Carolina, local nursing homes are using a variation of Bourgeois' techniques to give nursing home staff a better way to communicate with Alzheimer's patients. River Point Crest in New Bern houses about 60 patients in its Alzheimer's unit. Jennifer Wright is the administration's and marketing coordinator.
There is a sign up in their main activity dining room that tells them what day it is, the actual day, month, and year, what season they're in, what the weather is outside, and what the holiday is that's coming up, so that they can kind of keep in touch with what's going on in the world.
In addition to the calendar, the Alzheimer's unit occasionally uses signs to help the residents stay in the appropriate areas. Belinda Dillahunt is an LPN at River Point Crest.
We have stop signs that we used for residents wandering to another resident's room to keep them from getting agitated. We'll put a stop sign across the door. It's just a little linen piece with a stop sign on it, sticky, that they can come in and out. We work with that. Then we have, on the exit doors, we have a picture of a tree so they don't walk out, try to go out the door so often.
Bourgeois' technique works best when caring for a few Alzheimer's patients. Since River Point Crest serves almost 20 patients, they've had to adapt the technique to make it work in their facility.
We get to know each individual resident. We make their plan around them, not have a general plan for everybody, because it doesn't always work for everybody.
In North Carolina, there is close to 90,000 total nursing home residents. Of those, 42% have a severe case of dementia and 24% have a mild case. Alzheimer's is the fifth leading cause of death in the state. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Eastern Carolina Ear, Nose, and Throat, Head and Neck Surgery, Greenville, including Drs. Kamnitz, Albernez, Lindbeck, Brechtelsbauer, Brodish, and Workman, offering comprehensive medical and surgical management of diseases of the head and neck. Millions of North Carolinians have already cast their ballot as part of the early election, but some will wait until the general election on November 6th. This week, L.C. Morris explains North Carolina's election process.
Every 4 years, North Carolinians cast their ballot in the presidential general election, congressional, state, and local elections. This year, Democrat President Barack Obama is running against Republican Mitt Romney for the office of president. And Democrat Walter Dalton is facing Republican challenger Pat McCrory to be North Carolina's next governor. Johnny McClain is the deputy director of the North Carolina State Board of Elections.
The North Carolina ballot is designed to make it readily accessible and readable and votable, if you will, by the voter. The ballot contains complete instructions, and my suggestion to voters, especially if they are first-time voters, is to take just a minute to look at the ballot, read the instructions, know what is there. If you have any questions during this process, certainly ask the precinct officials.
If voters are unsure of who the candidates are or what they are running for, sample ballots are available at the North Carolina State Board of Elections website at www.ncsbe.gov. Click on the county where you will vote.
Having a sample ballot is always a good idea, because sometimes if their lines are long at the polling place, it is because people are giving thoughtful consideration to their choices on the ballot.
Voters may not remember all of the candidates, so they may stand at the voting booth and take a few seconds per office. It may slow down the process.
If a voter has done their research and made their decisions prior to going to the voting place and marked them on a sample ballot, it does make it easier for the voter.
For first-time voters, it can be intimidating. The term general election is used principally to distinguish it from primary elections, by-elections, and special elections. General election voting is not relegated to voting just one party.
Voters' party affiliation has nothing to do with the choices that they can make on the general election ballot. They are able to vote a straight party ticket if they so choose, or they can do what is called crossover voting, so that they vote a straight party ticket, but then for a particular office or offices, they cross over to the other party and make selections. And then, of course, we have nonpartisan offices that are not included in the straight party vote, as well as the office of president and vice president is not included with a straight party vote.
On the ballot this year, voters will see some candidates without a challenger, and some will opt not to vote because they see that the person has already won. McClain says the candidate would still have to be elected.
Interestingly enough, the law requires that every elected official be elected. So even if there is no opposition for a particular candidate in a particular office, that candidate would need to receive at least one vote in order to be elected to that office. And I do believe that that person would receive at least the one vote, because you know that person will vote for him or herself.
A voter can choose which races they want to vote on. McLean adds that paying attention to the ballot and reading the instructions, whether it is a touchscreen ballot or an optical scan printed ballot, will help minimize mistakes and moves the process along.
Generally speaking, as a society, we don't want to read instructions and don't usually resort to the instructions unless we have parts or pieces left over. And instructions are printed there to make it easier for the voter.
Early voting ends November 3rd at 1 p.m. throughout the state. Same-day registration is available during the early voting period. General election is Tuesday, November 6th. Polls are open from 6:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. To see who is running for office in your area, log on to publicradioeast.org. I'm L.C. Morris.
This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East.